Just before you start, which was some players asked me to clarify, is your image within there, including the New Zealand tax and my
eye? No,
they
will be called on that day. Oh,
okay, right. So we're just dealing with the Van Ash.
Van Ash, Broomfield, Hadley and Triple P.
Right.
Woodlock Properties submission, that submission point that I've drawn, so.
The Woodlock Property one, yes.
Yeah. So
it's only part of that 1163?
Yes, it's only 501.14. So that other submissions will come up.
Could you then presume, do you have a summary in your question?
Sorry?
Do you have a special summary?
No,
that's okay. Could you just then clarify which parts of your evidence we should delete?
Sure.
In terms of the Woodland property.
Sure. Part 6 of my evidence on page 27 and finishing on 28. So I guess that section just isn't called or presented.
Yeah. We're just printed as non-existent. We're dealing with parts 5 onwards then today.
Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Starting on page 25. Well, the heading is on 25. The text starts the next page. Yeah.
Okay.
My questions relate to part 8 in regard to the Temple Peak station.
Yeah.
So this is the motor vehicle repair. So this is for me to try and clarify my own understanding of how these rules might work, is that your clients workshop associated with the station is land that's zoned rural lifestyle.
Yes.
But the bigger property and part of that is zoned rural general.
Rural general.
And it's this rule here that would restrict, wouldn't allow them effectively to undertake that. You're referring your evidence to Mr. Barr considered it in another situation where it was to do with the how it was associated with the residential component of it. Have you considered any way where it could be considered as part of the overall operation of the rural station that could potentially accommodate your client's situation.
Yeah, I understand the SPA has said in Section 42A report that home occupations are permitted within the lifestyle zone, and repairing a motor vehicle could be considered part of a home occupation. However, the way that I read the rule says that it's a prohibited activity to do the motor vehicle repair. Whether it's part of a home occupation or not, it has to comply with that prohibited activity rule, which obviously means so what I was suggested is, at least for the rural lifestyle zone, taking motor vehicle repair out of the prohibited activity act. So farmers who do have rural lifestyle zone on their properties, and there aren't many of those, 10 pieces, so I think it's quite an unusual situation that legally they'll be allowed to continue to repair vehicles, boat vehicles on their properties.
Would that have a flow-on consequence for in the rural lifestyle zone for where people could then undertake motor vehicle repairs on some basis? I don't want to call it commercial or industrial,
yeah.
Or what have you. Does your suggestion create other problems?
No, I don't think so, because commercial and industrial activities are separately controlled through the rural lifestyle zone, so the discretionary or non-employing activity. So, not creating an as-of-right situation on a commercial or industrial basis to repair motor vehicles. Yeah, it's really those words in the prohibited activity status really are just private vehicles in this case.
I'm just perhaps thinking out loud that the situation we're dealing with, and it might be better to say that the prohibited activity excludes those activities which are part of a farming operation or a home occupation.
Yeah.
Because home occupations have their own limitations, and a farming activity has its natural, I would have thought, farmers do tend to repair their own vehicles if they can.
And I'm pretty sure that's what the rural area prohibited activity book does.
I was looking for that, and I couldn't find it quickly, but a few points to that would help.
I do sound like evidence that if say on Temple Peak Station they wanted to repair vehicles, but then they technically would take it to the rural general zone to me, which is only a couple hundred metres from the actual workshop where they fix vehicles. I must have looked at the rural general area to find out that it wasn't a prohibited activity at that level, but what they're saying is
I must confess, in my younger days, I did actually do some repairs of my own vehicle at home, and I would have thought it's an ordinary part on the residential activity and farming activity, and maybe that's what.
Yeah, well, that's the other interesting thing about the rule, because it's the same in residential zones and other zones. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of people change the oil and or whatever in a residential zone, and it's really not a big problem in the different environment. Mm.
Would you distinguish the motor vehicle repair from the other activities in that list of activities in terms of their potential effects?
Yeah, the wording of the rule is motor vehicle repair or dismantling.
Well, I was meaning all of the rules.
Oh, all of the rules.
From the other activity, including panel beating, spray painting,
etc. Yeah, certainly in residential zones, but I wouldn't agree with any of those. But rural lifestyle zones, you do have reasonably large defects and things, so some of those could occur. I see as far as recommending an exception for commercial fishery meat processing. So obviously we have to see those rules on the ground, and there are some exceptions to those rules.
I think those in Mr. Barr's response to that was in regard to home occupations. That was the connection there. This is just operating on memory. But that rule where it includes quite a list of things in there. You often advise about how many of those are actually listed or require an offensive trade licence under the Health Act at all?
No, I'm not familiar with that. So. I know the fish processing is.
I think bottle or scrap storage might be, but I'm not sure of the other. Through you, Mr. Chair, I wonder if Mr. Barr would be able to advise where in the rural chapter we might find that repairs to motor vehicles might can be carried out as part of the farming activity. Is that specified anywhere on the
plane? No, I think it's silent. And those two, the reference to the prohibited range of activities is unique to the rural chapter 8 and now chapter 22, so the rural lifestyle and rural residential zones. So there isn't a corresponding rule, and that perhaps comes back to the activities being undertaken as part of a residential activity or a part of the farming operation.
Given what Mr. Barr has just said, what's your view on the Chair's suggestion that it includes the idea of the Chair's suggestion would be that it wouldn't remove it in regards to the rural lifestyle zones, which is what it's in there for, but in terms of where it's being undertaken as part of the farming activity, that sort of like a, what do you think about that suggestion?
So farming activity is defined as the use of clean and buildings for the primary purpose of the production of vegetable matters for commercial livestock. Excluding the whole list of things, provided that was interpreted to include vehicles for agricultural
use. The rules should be drafted to be explicitly excluded where it is part of farming operations and part of residential activities. But what I agree, wondering is your opinion, if it was to do that, would that create unforeseen issues potentially? I'm trying to think wider than your clients.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. If you look at the majority of the rural lifestyle zones, most of them are being farmed as such. Most of them are just lifestyle properties, which and again, the setbacks from internal boundaries and pretty much ensures any workshops or buildings where you would do that activity is set back quite a distance from most of the boundaries. So I can't see any sort of reverse extension issues. And it's pretty much a temporary activity. If you've got a car that you have to fix every night, then you should probably get no car.
So I think that, so in your view, from can I take it what you're saying, it's a matter of the scale.
Yeah. Outside of the situation of a station having sort of something
for a school. Look at it the other way. What would be your view on commercial operations of any of those activities in that zone?
Yeah, I wouldn't be too concerned about most people repair and such, but you know, provided the amenity of the zone is maintained, and if you have to go through a discretionary or non-compliant activity to achieve that on a commercial basis, then it's going to be pretty thorough to look at.
My next question is just in regard to 919 of your evidence.
Yep.
And just when I was looking at the, I think it's comment 24 where you attach that as part of your evidence to attachment B. Including that particular objective about the life supporting capacity of water, is that within a function of QLDC to be able to have objectives and policies such as that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and this particular objective was inserted into the office plan through the specific process when the rural residential zone at the head of Bay Hayes was approved by council.
So is it a plan change number?
No, it was not a plan change. It was part of the district, the proposed district plan at the time.
That's all.
Yeah. And actually, I might be wrong in that way. It may have been on appeal to the Environment Court. Most of the zone but the zone was approved on the basis that it was that the water quality of Mill Creek, which runs into Bay Hay, is protected. I can probably find either the Environment Court decision or the consent order which approves that. But certainly from my experience, resource consent applications in that particular area have looked at water quality as part of the application in terms of designing subdivision, stormwater runoff, etc. So it's certainly useful. I'm not sure if it answers your question whether it is functional district council or not, but it is part of integrated management.
How does that affect it as well? How does that fit within the, since it's not in there, the plan is notified, by putting it in there, how does that relate to the strategic direction document, and does it link back to that in any way?
I haven't looked at it in much depth. I certainly wasn't involved in any strategic directives which dealt with that particular subject matter. I just want to say that not there. There's certainly nothing specifically from my memory in the strategic directives about more creative and back page.
Thank you. Just one question in relation to the support of the Hadley's submission to 9.38 and 9.39 in your evidence.
Yes.
Just talking about informal airports, and then we go forward to comments 33 and 34 in the attachment statement. Given the type of effects that were anticipated by informal airports, why the distinction between rural lifestyles and rural residential zone?
Two reasons. Firstly, the habit submission is only in relation to the rural residential zone. So I wasn't sure if there was scope to actually have the rural lifestyle zone as well. And secondly, it comes down to the density and size of allotments within the rural residential zone compared to the rural lifestyle zone, which can be, five times the size. So there may be more scope at the discretionary activity if they had informal reports in the last one.
Okay. Thank you.
On the same page, paragraph 1.34, talking about community activities.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think as a matter of principle that urban activities should be confined to the urban parts of the district?
Unless they have a function of need in the rural area, I agree.
In paragraph 9.23 on page 24, that's the second bullet point. You're talking there about the ODP scale, nature site standards, and effects on visitor activity, visitor accommodations.
What page?
Sorry, page 34. I'm just wondering, from what your comments there, would you consider that even in the visitor accommodation subzone, visitor accommodation should be at a scale similar to what would be expected if the site was used for residential? Is that what the suggestion?
Yes. And the Hopkins district plan certainly does that by including a site standard which restricts the size of buildings where the proposed district plan doesn't do that same thing. So, certainly within the rural residential, rural lifestyle, sort of accommodation subzone.
Sorry, could you speak up a little bit?
So, within the subzones, certainly visitor accommodation should be restricted to maintaining that level of rural amenity or rural character.
Do you think, therefore, or is it the corollary that in the rural lifestyle zone where a building platform is required, that any visitor accommodation should be located within the building platform?
That would make sense. Some lifestyle zones where visitor accommodation has grown very large over time. One example is Mount Carey Lodge, just up the road here.
It would be best if you didn't go into detail on that, because Commissioner St. Clair has a conflict of interest with that.
So
if you keep it in the generalities,
you know, there's a huge pressure on visitor accommodation at the moment, and with the amount of visitors, projected visitors coming here over the next few years, it's going to quadruple or whatever, and so there's going to be increased pressure on these areas. Where there's a subzone at present, under the proposed plan, could build something very large there, which is out of character with the purpose of that zone.
Page 31. To the top of the page in 9.3 suggested a reference to rural character and amenity values. Are you able to help us with what characteristics you think make up rural character?
Rural character.
Planners and landscape architects use, but I'm trying to get each of them to tell me what elements are in it.
It is a difficult one. I guess, if you say you drive through the Dalefield area and through the rural lifestyle zone there, to me, rural character is the little stalls selling walnuts or pine cones or horse glue or whatever. The roads don't have the curb and channel. It's almost an informal type feel to the area. necessarily open, but it's obviously domesticated. But at a key speed where you have a ride on Norma or your sheep or pony or whatever, it's a gross amount. So, it's a transition between residential and town.
With rural character separated from the rural lifestyle, in a general sense, is there a point at which the intensity of development stops at being rural? Is there still they go to to help us understand and where that point might be?
I guess if you look at some of the resort zones or special zones, they are probably at the point where say Millbrook Resort, for example, that in my opinion has moved from rural character to a more manicured character in terms of golf courses, knowing livestock, knowing sort of more of a formal corporate sector. It is a difficult one to answer because a lot of rural residential, rural lifestyle zones are on the outskirts of the urban areas, and therefore their purpose is to blend into the farming need.
Now, next we have just getting the cold.
And
I'm presuming we're going to use both slots because after that we have Susan Cleaver and Carol Martin.
Yep.
And you're going to use both slots together, that's fine, right?
So,
I presume
we have a change of plan for you, and that I will present on Tuesday for myself and Susan and the family included. My brother Stephen, who is at the end here, is just managing himself on the bus in Auckland, and Philip, my other brother here, was going to speak on Tuesday. So he and I are going to speak to you today, and I'm going to keep what I was going to say today until next week. But we do have a little bit of time, I might think a little bit of time to discuss an email I sent you last week.
And you may recognise that two of us heard you at the last
night. Yep.
Two
new ones. Okay, I'll read. Hello, my name is Philip Dunn, and I'm submitting on behalf of myself and my family. In this session, I'm going to discuss the submission my family has made to the annual plans for zone changes on their property. We own 150 hectares on Northern Ferry Road, Yarra Junction, where the Arrowtown, Gibson, and Lake Hazel Face trails all meet. We are intensive deer farmers on this property. However, the deer do not like walkers, cyclists, or dogs, and for them, the equivalent of living next door to a predator wandering around all the time. So, in essence, we need to look at changing what we're doing on our farm. When the Queenstown Cycle Trail was in the planning stage, we had K-Park from the Queenstown Trails Trust, Paul Wilson from the Kew, and from the QLDC. Instead of that dining table and getting a very hard sell on the economic benefits of the cycle trail, which now passes through and in front of our property. We also had Mayor Vanessa, councillors, dock staff and influential community leaders, and many others walk the proposed trail across our property with us. Everybody was 100% behind the idea of it. We now have the trail in place, and yes, it is amazing. So amazing that this week it has been announced the central government, central Lakes Trust and New Saving Community Trust are contributing $26 million towards joining this trail with the other central Otago Trust. We asked the panel to think about that for a minute. $26 million is a huge amount of money. And it clearly shows how serious central government and the community are about trails that traverse the rural areas of Otago and New Zealand. And I want you to think about that financial commitment from the government and those groups with regard to this document, the annual plan. You're drafting a document that needs to reflect the energy of confidence that's been put into the trail and the rules around. We believe that this document, i.e. the annual plan, needs to be an enabling document in all respects. However, in particular, we think that this document needs to be enabling around the cycle trail to encourage development that allows people to live and create industry along the trail. Morgan Ferry provides a fantastic opportunity in the Wakasubu Basin for this to happen. It is at the junction of the trails from Queenstown and Arrowtown before the future hit trail heads off down the Quarry Gorge to Cromwell and beyond. It is undulating, sunny, north-facing and also contained. Mandy Kennedy and her crew from the Queenstown Cycle Trail are very supportive and enthusiastic about our plan. Mandy has told us that if the zone change happens, it would be the first in New Zealand and a great economic boost for the trails around the country, that this concrete evidence that the trails are creating economic activity. With all of this in mind, we're submitted that the zoning around the trail on Morgan Ferry Road be changed to reflect this, with the rural visitor zone, the junction of the trails, are joined by rural residential and rural lifestyle zoning along the trail, enabling economic activity to develop organically around the trail, justifying the commitment we've seen by so many people, including my family and I. The building of the trail has been a major event in our life on the property. And we've been there for 70 years as a family, and father and grandfather. Apart from the massive amount of time and money it has cost us over literally years, it has affected us immeasurably in many other ways. Some of the rules for the rural area are very restrictive in regards to the Wakarapu Basin. They may well work for other intensively farmed areas in QLDC such as Kauwea Flat. During the strategic plan hearings we gave evidence that the rural areas of Wakarapu Basin should be thought of in different aspects of that of other rural areas in QLDC. It's not been reflected in the it should be on the end, but I want to get back to that anyway. We believe our concept of development around the trail and believe it creates an amazing opportunity for you as writers of the new district plan to be proactive and embrace the trail and create zoning for opportunities around us on behalf of the QLDC. Now, going back to those rules in Chapter 22, you consider much of the Wakarapu Basin rural general. And you also consider the Lakes of Kauwea Flat rural general. They are very different areas. We'd just like to make that point clear for the panel. We don't think that the zoning for Kauwea Flat should be the same as the zoning for the Wakarapu Basin. One other thing that I would like to touch on is in the new policy and rules that have come out, you've changed the policy and rules for farm buildings, buildings in rural areas. Can anybody see any reason why you see that?
We didn't change, we haven't changed anything, yeah, so it's not us.
Because it completely baffles us. As farmers, we have 150 hectares. On that 150 hectares, we have 9 farm buildings. All 9 of those buildings are used. And in the new rules and policy that you've put out, you've got, what is it, 1 per...
They've changed it from 1 per 50 hectares in the first draft to 1 per 100 hectares in the second draft.
And then...
It's not that difficult, but it really is.
If anybody has a rural block of land and they own a sheep or a goat or anything, they need a building for storing food. That animal has the right to have dry food at the shelf. So if you're in the rural area and you don't have animals, you need to have the right if the animal deserves dry food and shelter, which means that they deserve some kind of building. Allowance for a building. If you're in horticulture and you have machinery, it needs to be covered. A lot of those, that machinery is incredibly expensive, and if out in the weather, it will deteriorate very quickly. So, yeah, the rules about ground farm buildings need to change.
I'd probably like to wait because I think my questions might be to all three
right.
Together.
Right, Stephen's going to talk on rural here, so that's
fine. Oh, okay. Alright, can I clarify then, Mr. Bowen, that in terms of the rural visitor zone,
yeah.
You suggested there, so that's included within a submission regarding that, right? With,
yep.
So, if you provide any detailed rule about what should be in possibly the wording or anything like that? For that zone?
For that zone, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That would be double from the
map. And then we'll be able to put the map in there.
Yeah.
The next few questions I might get the same answer from the thinking on my lead. Have you considered all this visitor accommodation sub-zone that applies to the rural area? Have you thought about that, whether that would be useful? Or
well, we've used planners to draw up the plan or the proposed plan, and it is running along, well, beside the trail, the proposed rural visitor zone put in is running along the same lines as Millbrook or Jack's Forest. Yeah. With I think their density is down to 5%. Yeah.
We do have one area in it for the next year for density, which is right beside the junction of the trails where we would envisage the cafe type.
And just to clarify, Mr. Chair, that's all going to be dealt with, those parts of that in regards to the matter.
Yes. Essentially, the effect is that rezoning for the property,
yeah.
and we will treat that as a whole package.
I think the crux of our submission and what we want to get across to is that we farmed here, a grandfather came here in 1950, we've been farming here ever since. The changes in the last 10 years have been more than they were in the 60 years previous to that, as far as farming goes in the Rocket State. And this is, I heard you asking this, the previous submitter about what he considers to be rural. Rural in the Rocket Basin is not farming. Farming does not exist in the Wakarui Basin. There's a few people who are hanging on, but if you talk to any of those people, they are just hanging on, and that's literally all they're doing. and that includes us. And the trail has severely affected the management and running of the deer farm, and they really are not compatible. So we need to look at changing our use. Sheep are also not compatible with the number of dogs around our property. They're there all the time, every day. We could go to dairy grazing, our neighbours would have that sort of physical problem and thinking of that. It's a rural lifestyle area. Tourists also have no respect for animals. They have no idea how to act around them.
Thinking of that, we have a lot of submissions from landowners around the Morgan area, and I just want to build up a little bit of a map here as to where those ownerships are. I'm just wondering if I can hand this over and maybe you can mark the boundaries of the regions.
Just to write on there.
Yeah, just a rough line around the boundary. Just in terms of the other larger lots that are in the general area around Morgan Ferry, do you know if they're contemplating some sort of land use change?
Next door to us, we have, there's 150 acres owned by John Martin and John Darby, and they have submitted, put a joint submission and decided our ones to make that more residential.
Copy of that.
I guess in terms of the trail itself and you know, the areas with the push going forward, I'm wondering if I could use your experience to help us understand. Could there have been anything that would have been done better or through the mitigation that could have taken place around that trail that wouldn't have had such an impact on rural land.
That's a question.
Absolutely. And Mr. McDonald was here, and he was on that committee that came and talked to us about the trail, where it went. And we had paved roads on our property, and so we had no option. But Mr. McDonald was there, and if you don't mind, I'm going to quote this. He sat down at our kitchen table and told us that the trail had a shotgun pointed at our head, and they would pull the trigger. And they did. And so we ended up with this trail going through our property where they could have gone around the site and things like that. And that is one of the reasons why it has had such a massive impact on our management. That is a very short answer to a very long question.
Right.
And I like saying that. Yeah. So in terms of those,
does the track follow the paper road? No. And the Trails Trust didn't want the trails to be on the paper roads, simply because on paper roads they have little control over who is passing over the trail. On private land it has an easement for walkers and cyclists. So the trail has an easement for walkers and cyclists, so only walkers and cyclists are permitted to use the trail. Which gives the Trails Trust much more control.
Council needs to read the land trust for that and discover its final pass.
Yeah.
And part of that was Doc and the Looking at Feds Commissioner of New Zealand all came on board, and with a lot of discussion and expenditure from our part of the family, a lot of expenditure from the Trails Trust, a lot of expenditure from Doc, we had to realign all our boundaries along the Arrow River. And the trail was then placed outside of our boundary on the Arrow River verge. And we closed the paper roads on the Public Works Act on that particular site, and realigned we've got land with Doc, we've got land with QLDC. And basically realigned that whole upright edge of that farm on our road side. And then on the Northern Ferry side of our road, on the Diamond Circle side of the farm, we're still trying to go through the process of closing that paper road, but it seems to have got stalled somewhere along the line.
That was all part of the negotiations. We did that. We're going to get the trail, and we're getting the trail because we have paper roads. We want the paper roads close.
And just while we're on that, we do have a document at home that's on the Trails Trust, which unfortunately I wasn't able to find today, but I will find it by Tuesday, that says that no view from the Kumpapa Trail can be taken into consideration when doing a subdivision. And yet in the proposed rules in here, they have got, and I just don't have it straight in front of me, that has appeared in the second draft, so it needs to be removed as well, because there is a document from the QLDC to say that that will never happen. It's specific to the land, it's specific to any trail, any trail, yeah. And any land.
I know the rules you make about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And hindsight,
would
it
have
been better to get the
track
on the
paper
road?
No, they couldn't, the trail was the most appropriate place for the trail. Mm-hmm. If they put them on the paper road, it would have been a very poor run trail.
And also there would have horses, cars, trucks, anything that needs, and that on the New Zealand Cycle Trail, conditions of what they can have. They only have walkers and cyclists. No horses.
I'm trying to build a grade one cycle trail, which is two riders can ride along side by side quite comfortably. Obvious riders can ride side by side comfortably.
Thank you.
No. So my name's Stephen. a third member in the family. I'm the pilot in the family, so.
Do you have some of the
I do, but it's, I changed it on the plane on the way down, so it's not going to be relevant. So sorry about that. I can get it to you later if that's all right.
Okay, thank you.
So I was brought up on the farm, obviously, with these people, but I started flying when I was 16. I had to fly at the Waka Verifas here, just so I'm straight in there, and flew Queen's Down to Milford for 7 or 8 years. Since then, I've basically been working for airlines, working for New Zealand at the moment, so I've been flying in and out of here for the last 30 years, basically. So, that's the background where I'm coming from, and our concern about the informal airports is that it compromises the current airspace, basically, within the basin, and that the rules that are proposed for them would preclude most of them from being used. I'll read my little skill. It says the proposed rule change for informal airports needs to reflect the proud history of general aviation and its contribution to the success of this district. It also needs to give general aviation a confident future so that it continues to play an important part in the ongoing success of the district. Whilst the alterations to the original plan change proposal are a step in the right direction, they still fail to assure a confident future for general aviation, and also fail to achieve one of the main objectives of the rule change, which was to reduce the amount of resource consents required to operate at informal airports. They are also very biased towards helicopters. As a mission, is that 3 points need to change to ensure a positive future for general aviation. So rule 21.5.26.1 has a daily movement limit of 2. A daily movement limit of 2 would severely restrict access to informal airports and will still require resource consent to be filed when more than 2 movements a day are required. Aviation is not a linear business, and approximately 1/3 of flying days are lost due to weather. So there needs to be a mechanism to bank the movements that are not used on the non-flying days. If council is comfortable with 2 movements a day, then those 2 movements should be able to be averaged out over a month or even a year to create some flexibility and to reduce the resource consent applications that would be required. The other rule is 21.5.25.4 and 21.5.26.3, which is the 500 metre setback rule. The 500 metre setback from any other zone has no credible basis as a setback because it's an arbitrary figure which was basically plucked from thin air and put into the documents. It was in the southern planning document, just the number they proposed because they thought it seemed like a good number. Many current airstrips would not meet this criteria, although they have happily operated in the community for years. They should be protected for future use. For new airstrips, QLDC needs to commission a noise expert to construct a noise standard for both helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft. Next rule is 21.5.25.3 and 21.5.26.2, which is training. The list of prohibited activities at informal airports, training needs to be included in that permitted activities list. The reason for that, a big part of light aircraft flying every day, whether private or commercial, is being prepared to land in case of an engine or airframe malfunction. And our airstrips provide a safe place to put down in this case. To be confident to use an airstrip in an emergent situation requires practice in the form of a good number of approaches and landings from either end of the airstrip on different days and in different wind conditions. For the training to be effective and for pilots to be confident in their abilities, they need to be unencumbered, by movement limits. In conclusion, aviation is a valid and important part of our area, and it could flourish in a sustainable manner by replacing daily movement limits with a bankable movement system. Council needs to protect the current airstrips in the district. The council needs to commission a noise standard for both fixed-wing and helicopters for any new informal airports. And lastly, training at informal airports needs to be unencumbered by movement limits.
if you could, can you tidy it
yes,
up?
Yes, I will tidy it up.
Please provide a copy to the Sanderman.
Yes, we will do.
Sorry, just, I'm just trying to, I recall, according to council, changed the number of the limit as you were talking about.
It was originally did 3 a week.
Well,
to two a day.
I think now, I thought, Dr. Charles has changed it to another.
2 a day. So then 14 per week.
14 per week, so.
Oh,
2 a day or 14 a week.
So is that 14 per week flexible?
Yes. 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 Yes, two per day or 14 per week.
Okay, so it's two per day, the maximum you can do within a day. Mm-hmm. 4 a day and none the next day, is that permissible?
I can't recall the exact wording you suggested. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I understand your point about banking, so
yeah.
That would be Dr. Griffin.
Yeah.
We can take account.
You lose a lot of movements because of weather and stuff like that. So the noise problem doesn't get any worse if you bank 14 a week or you just do a day, 15 days, you know.
The last point that you made, something along the lines of to be confident, pilots need to be unencumbered by daily movement limits. Are you suggesting no limits at all for pilot training?
Yeah, so and here at the moment, emergency landings, rescues, firefighting and activities, and tillery farming activities basically are unrestricted.
Yeah.
So all I'm saying is that training needs to be put in that category as well.
Okay. Thank you. And what was that for number?
It is, there's two references for us. It is 21.5.25.3 and 21.5.26.2.
Wanted to clarify as well. So you suggested that we need to check that, or the document needs to check the current airport, but those airports have been operating happily with only 3 flights per week.
No, there has been no 3 flights per week. At the moment, basically, the airstrips have just been operating as of right for an airstrip, for an informal airport for helicopter landings and stuff like that.
So there's no restriction at all? No.
But also in the Southern Planning Report, there has also been no complaints, no noise complaints. So that would tend to suggest that the current airstrips are not operating even near their limits for noise. So.
How many informal airports do you think there are in the
Well, it's unlimited for helicopters, because helicopters can land anywhere. But it's different for fixed wing aeroplanes, because whereas a helicopter can land in this room, a fixed wing needs, you know, a 400 metre airstrip and a safe approach and a safe missed approach. And so it's a much bigger area, so there is a lot less of it. And so current airstrips in the basin would number probably half a dozen off the top of my head. Just right in the basin, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Did you use that?
Yeah.
All right. So that's fine. You'll see where you
get it. Yeah, okay.
Endlessly fun.
Sir, I will introduce myself. My name is Neil Thomas McDonald. I've been practising as a surveyor in the Lakes District for 29 years. I am the principal, in fact I am one of the principals of Clark Fortune McDonald and Associates, and on this occasion I'm also a trustee to the NT McDonald Family Trust, and I'm appearing today as counsel for the submissions referenced on the cover sheet. And sir, I'm making submissions in primarily in respect to two rules, Rule 21.46 and 22.512. They're not supported by their respective Section 32 evaluation reports. This restriction to only construct one residential unit within an approved residential building platform has been introduced into the proposed district plan without sufficient and comprehensive analysis, and policies 2.12.1 and 2.12.3, you know, the average rules were introduced for subdivision of land holdings in the Dalefield zone. And sir, perhaps I should give some background to those. There's two points really. One was the more than one dwelling house in the building platform in the rural general zone, as it was, and in the rural lifestyle zone. So I believe there's no reason to change the status quo as it was in the Hockham district plan. There's been no evidence that the unrestricted ability to build more than one dwelling unit within a 1,000 square metre building platform that has led to any difficulty in the district. In fact, it's very rarely used, but I think it's even more important to retain the option to use that, sir. We were seeing now in this district large dwellings being built in both the rural zone and the rural lifestyle zones for what I would call very infrequent use, if you like, sir. They're holiday homes, and they only be occupied for 2 or 3 weeks a year, otherwise they sit there unoccupied. And I think this, the ability to build a second unit in the same building platform, attached or detached, gives the opportunity for at least an occupied dwelling, be it rental or care taken, in that area. And I think that just is another one of those matters that helps or assists in the future or providing for housing in the district. So it was of interest that 20 years ago I went to the Aston area for a mountain village conference on behalf of Queenstown, and one of the major problems they had in that area back then was the large dwellings trophy dwellings, if you like, in the county surrounding Aston that were basically left unoccupied, and the council's actually reacted to that and required a second dwelling to be built on those property and to be permanently occupied. I'm not saying we go that far in this district, but at least we should retain the ability to do that.
Well, I suppose that my mother does the same thing. The critical question is, do you consider it appropriate to provide the subdivision of those building platforms?
Yes, that's a difficult one, sir.
Well, not if they're doing what yours are doing. Well, then it would be sensible to say no, they shouldn't.
Yeah, well, we have the ability now to do a rural living unit, I think it's called, a residential living unit attached to an existing dwelling as an ancillary, and there's a definition associated with that which restricts floor area in a comparison with the main dwelling. But the important point with that is that there is no ability to subdivide in that case. Of course, look at the effect of subdivision and would say that I can't see a reason why, if the buildings were within the one platform attached or detached, that they couldn't be subdivided.
But then wouldn't you create two platforms in each of those?
No, another you would in effect, but they would be contiguous and still within the 1,000 square metres. And in terms of an effect-driven approach to it, I see no difference in that effect between that separately owned or rented as opposed to the existing situation with the residential living units.
Can I follow up? Wouldn't say that a subdivider require each to provide a building platform that needs to be between 17,000 square metres?
They would. They would as it currently exists in the that would be very simple because we are required, and I don't know why we do this. But when we subdivide in the rural zone now, and if there's an existing dwelling house that could have been there for many years, we're required by the planning regime in this district to show a new platform around that existing dwelling house in addition to a completely separate platform elsewhere on a new allotment. Now, I see it, that situation would be no different. You'd be showing two new platforms, which were really a creation as part of the surrounding the original buildings.
Isn't the follow-on from that then? They had one that was 1,000 and they've got 500 each, and actually now they've got two, and they've got 1,000, or over that they could do another 2 houses.
Yeah, I can see that problem, which is... Yep, and I would be happy to have a mechanism by which it was restricted to the external perimeters of the original platforms. I wouldn't want to go beyond those at all. So just on a specific basis, the NT McDonald Family Trust, so that opens a property on Lower Shotover Road which contains with Fortune McDonald Survey Offices. It's 4,000 square metres in area, and I am in the process of applying for a building platform there, sir. And that was as an example, sir, I intend to build two attached dark housing units. Because of the difficulty we're currently having with housing and getting started in this district. So that's just a simple example. think there's a continuing need to use as efficiently as possible these options available here. And there's really nothing being put in the Section 32 analysis as to why there is a problem with the current situation at least. I'm just trying to understand how the rules work, so bear with me and see if my understanding is right. I'm just looking at Table 1 and the rules zone, and this looks like how to help with this as well. So you can have one residential unit on another platform, that's the one you've raised as a concern. Then it says the residential flat is a permitted activity. The specific rules for construction of any buildings apply. Then there's a separate rule which says the construction and exterior alteration of buildings located within the platform. But I'm not quite sure whether that's a different.
It's carried over from the.
I'm not quite sure what that.
It's a carryover from the operative district plan service, which was to allow people to extend or alter the existing building within the building platform without necessarily having to go through other than the controlled activities. And that's presumably why, sir, we were creating these building platforms on subdivision around existing buildings.
I wonder if the issue is, because my understanding of the family flat is it's still a self-contained residential unit.
That's correct, sir.
But the problem is that while it's allowed, there's actually no way that you could have a building for it, because the buildings, the way I read it, it's going to be at a minimum discretionary. Is that
what's possible? Yeah, I think that is another problem with that, sir.
Okay. And that may be a drafting problem.
No, I would have thought so.
Mr. Barr might address us back on that in his reply as to whether it was one of those unforeseen consequences of the way the rules have been drafted. So.
Thank you, sir. The other matter, sir, which I'll call the average of the 2 hectare average rule, sir, just to give a bit of background as I see how that rule has actually promulgated itself over the years through the planning regime here. Prior to the Cowdery's Amendment Act 1972, so you may be aware that subdivision was permitted down to 10 hectares without approval.
There's only a few of us ultimately.
Yeah, I thought it might be. I can't recall doing any of these. But there was a rash of 4 hectare blocks, 10 acre blocks created in this district prior to that amendment. And the bulk of them were in the Dalefield subdivision, as we were called it, joining Nichols Road, Dalefield and Mountain View Road. There was another lot of those up in the Close Burn area of Queenstown. Most of those, because they didn't require any conditions of council or of any approval, ended up being designed as quite narrow frontages onto the existing legal road and quite deep on its design in order to avoid any construction costs of access, etc. It wasn't a good outcome at all, mind you, but that's what happened in those areas.
That explains the set just before you get to Close Burn, where they all run down the hill to the lake. That I thought that we visited there this morning, when I said to my colleagues, I thought they looked like one of those pre-1972
Yes, they certainly were, and they caused a lot of headaches after that in terms of access or no legal access over right of item instructions, etc. But the council, the Queenstown Lakes District Council, sir, even prior to the Resource Management Act, did bring a rule in under the County Country Planning Act and Local Government Act regimes to allow those allotments to be subdivided into two. And I mean, there was pressure for continued rural lifestyle type subdivision in the rural general area. That promulgated through to the district, first district plan review, which was notified in 95. When that was notified in 95, the Dalefield area and the Close Bend area and other areas that had these similar allotments were identified as rural residential, was proposed as rural residential, I should say, and they were proposed to have minimum lot areas of 4,000 square metres, and the average wasn't promulgated there. It was as a result of the submissions primarily opposing that from the residents in the Dalefield area that wanted to protect their amenity that council proposed the rural lifestyle zone as a result of decisions in 98. It wasn't a zone that was sought, it was a zone that came out as a result of decisions, and it brought in the average 2 hectare rule. So what I'd say about that was the general public were never given the opportunity to submit on that particular zone at that time. Coming up, they could have had the opportunity to take a reference or an appeal to the Environment Court. Nobody did, so it was never ever challenged, and it sat there like that to this day. Now, what I'm saying about that is I can understand why in the Dalefield area and the Close Bend area, which are not flat but have undulating character, and because of the narrowness of the lots there, why there was a need to probably have the minimum 1 hectare, average 2 hectares, to protect their existing amenity values in there. However, sir, I don't think that the average 2 hectare rule was required when you are looking at rural lifestyle or rural residential, we'll call them rural lifestyle zones, where they can be developed on flatter land, and particularly as a greenfield approach, where you can design in amenity. I think you can design that in efficiently without the 2 hectare average, just based on the 1 hectare minimum rule. Now, we've seen that happen quite extensively, and I'm sure you'll hear from Mr. Goldsmith in the future about the Acadian Triangle is located between
about 20 minutes.
Yeah, so just warming him up. But
well, I have to say, we're hoping to have a break before then. So
yeah, so that area seems to be successfully developed now. For housing at 1 hectare minimum size, and I think there's other areas which the council have zoned going down Lower Shotover Road and other areas which have the same type of character as that flat area, a character that I don't think is similar to the Dalefield area. And
so, when you say flat land, what do you mean by flat land?
I'm indicating more the River Terrace flats that exist in the district as opposed to the rolling downs country.
And the zones that they're identified in the plan cover both?
Yes.
Both those areas?
They do. They don't make the distinction.
In your submissions that the in the river flats is something that's more appropriate to have the 1 hectare without a
I think you could basically double the density
right.
in the
second edge. That 2 hectare.
Yes. And I'm submitting that the Acadian Triangle between the main road, Speargrass Flat, and the Trotter Road is an example of that.
But on the rolling downs, you'd be thinking that
I think the average is probably appropriate in those areas. It's far more difficult to access on those areas and to get suitable building platforms that keep amenity distances when you've got gullies and flats.
So in effect, what you're suggesting is there should be two subzones of the rural lifestyle. One.
I don't want to make it complicated, see what it seems like.
Yeah, it seems fair. Thank you. Good, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Neil. For the main commissioners, or any more questions from you?
No.
I've provided a brief summary of my primary evidence for the purpose of the clarification at least. Paragraph 37 of my evidence or primary evidence remains incomplete, where the last sentence should read, the averages rule is considered to result in an inefficient subdivision of smaller land bodies.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Read that
for me
again so I can write it down.
Yeah, it's right at the top of my summary there, sir.
Oh, yeah.
And the other point with reference to my primary submission for evidence, rather, as I outlined, I had not read the Rural General Zone Monitoring Report of 2009 or the Rural Living Zone Monitoring Report of 2009. I have now done so, and I do not wish to make any subsequent amendments or change any conclusions reached in my evidence. In relation to the residential units and building platforms, the Section 42A reports for both Chapters 21 and 22 endorse the permitted construction of a residential flat as the effect of the flat is acceptable in association with the residential unit. I consider that the effects of both a flat and or a unit are directly relevant to their size and location, which are determined by the appropriate location of a residential building platform assessed within a robust discretionary consent regime. The size of building in the platform is further restricted by rules in the proposed district plan which impose the maximum size for any building being 500 square metres. The averages rules, the identification of a residential building platform within the rural lifestyle zone, is a discretionary activity and is subject to assessment criteria listed in my evidence, coupled with the objectives and policies of Landscape Chapter 6. I consider this planning framework to be sufficiently robust to preclude or refuse any residential building platform which would compromise landscape amenity, rural living character, and or rural amenity. Thank you.
Just on the residential flat, paragraph 22 of your evidence, what you're highlighting there, that problem that I discussed with Mr. McDonald,
yeah,
that it appears that the decision to have a flat but you can't build it, is that that's
yes.
what you're saying is the problem?
Exactly.
Right.
Yep.
On paragraph 23 of your primary evidence, I think that this is referring to 21.4.6, which is the rule relating to one residential unit per building platform. Arthur, could you explain the part there about would require discretionary resources under 221 of the RMA? I thought that was to do with consent notices.
It is. And that stems from the comments in the Section 42A report, which I believe was framed at any approved residential building platform would usually have a consent notice on it by way of the subdivision consent restricting it to one residential unit within the platform.
Oh, okay, so it wouldn't apply.
So, I'm simply saying that, that might be true, but in the event that you have to come back for a controlled resource consent to construct anyway, it's not necessarily so problematic that you could entertain as part of that a component to amend that consent notice to enable two units should the proposed district plan be offered to enable two residential units in the building plan.
So the method for amending a consent notice is a DA discretionary activity?
Correct.
In terms of paragraph 24, where you talk about, and you addressed it in your summary as well, this is just in regard to your view regarding a residential unit and a flat, is, and that 500 square metres. We've put aside for the moment the problem with the rule that the chair's referred to, is, in terms of that, this a standard on the residential flat, by way of the definition, restricting that to 70 square metres. Does that make a difference in your view in terms of the impact or effect that any proposed dwelling and residential flat might have compared to two full?
Yes and no. Yes, I think it does when you're trying to evaluate within the 500 square metres how much is associated with the unit, how much with the flat. And balanced with, I guess, my argument that if you have two units being split, perhaps 250 make 500 under that rule.
I'm asking with the 70 square metres, does anything to potentially reduce the effect of those, a dwelling rather compared to having two?
Yeah, by virtue of, yes it does.
Different from the
I think you would find larger lawns, whether they be manicured
or whether they'd be open in more of a partial sense, and it would start part, I would hope, from seeing picket fences to somewhat more of a rural style fence, if not for any reason than that it's cheaper to fence a larger lot. But also it does have that rural element to it. But again, I would have the issue that that is obviously my opinion, which is often a subjective topic, but I see the rural living areas as containing or flourishing in a lot of established and mature trees that probably wouldn't be able to afford the space within a larger lot in the residential sense.
Thank you, sir.